Hello, this is episode number 15 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, May 31st, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, and we have several interesting issues up for discussion this week. First, we'll hear how technological progress drives change in copyright law. Next, we'll talk about the Major League Baseball issue with Slingbox, a play-shifting technology. And finally, we'll talk about states considering new regulations for social networking sites. Joining me to discuss these topics are Technology Liberation Front contributors Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
Braden Cox of the Association for Competitive Technology. Hi, Braden.
Hi, Adam.
And we're pleased today to be joined by two very special guests, Professor Randy Picker, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Hello, Mr. Picker.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
And Eric Bangman, who is managing editor of Ars Technica.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, Professor Picker, let's start with you. Over at the University of Chicago Law School blog, you've recently penned a series of very provocative essays about the future of copyright law in the face of rapid ongoing technological change. That's something we spend quite a bit of time discussing at the Tech Liberation Front blog, so I know our listeners will be interested in hearing what you have to say on this front. So tell us a bit about why you've been thinking about these issues and what your conclusions are.
Sure. I don't know that I have conclusions, but let's start at the beginning. I think the beginning really goes back before Gutenberg. And what we want to focus on is how we create physical copies of work. And that's changed dramatically over time. It was very hard to create copies before Gutenberg. The printing press changes our ability to create genuine copies of works in a powerful way. And then obviously much more recently, and this is what gives rise to make copyright so interesting today, is that the emergence of distributed copying technologies, the Xerox machine, the cassette recorder, Napster, and the like, has sort of destabilized and decentralized who can make copies. That's got powerful consequences for how we make copies, and that in turn is going to cause some sort of feedback to copyright law itself.
Mm-hmm. Let me read one thing that I found particularly provocative in one of these essays, just to quote really quickly from it, and then get you to comment on it and another reaction from our participants here today. You say, quote, "These new technologies have altered the practical enforceability of the rights that law assigns to copyright owners. These core copyrights have to be judged by their actual effectiveness on the ground. We shouldn't be interested in theoretical rights that don't actually implement in the real world. The basic legal framing of copyright is at stake," end quote. Now, that's fairly provocative stuff. There are going to be some copyright holders out there who are very uncomfortable about what you're saying there. I mean, tell us, it almost sounds like you're saying not necessarily that copyright's doomed, but that there are some serious troubles ahead.
Well, I think that from a standpoint of how we evaluate law, laws that exist on the books and don't actually work in the real world, that's how we characterize sort of underdeveloped legal regimes. That's not how we think of powerful first world countries. Their laws are supposed to work. What's happened here obviously is, and Napster and the like, the P2P technologies are the best example of this, is that laws that exist on paper regarding the control that a copyright holder can exist over work, those are simply almost impossible to enforce right now. And we've gone through various strategies for enforcing those. Some of those are technological. Some of those involve suing consumers. But so far, the content producers are certainly losing, at least in the music space. I think they are nervous, and I think they've got good reason to be nervous about that.
And you make the point in one of these essays that this is what is one of the major changes in copyright law today, is that for the first time, industries and copyright holders are having to go after sort of end users or actual consumers. In the old days, they had to go after intermediaries engaged in mass copying and distribution, and that's creating a lot of tension or problems for the industry. Could you explain that a bit more?
Sure. I mean, it used to be the case that a professional would steal your work, and so maybe someone would make a movie out of a play you had written. That meant that that professional would have a good lawyer, you'd have a good lawyer, and the people involved would have some sense of the rules of the game. Consumers are now in a position where they're certainly able to copy and now able to create using remix technology and the like, mashups and the like. And the consequence of that is the consumers are now both distributors and copiers and creators using work to create work. And now they run run into all the copyright issues that used to be reserved to professionals.
Right. Let me invite Tim or Eric or Braden to jump in at any point here with a question or a comment.
One of the things that I think maybe looking at it from the opposite perspective, one of the things that has clearly happened is that the ability of the copyright holder to control access to his work has obviously diminished. But I think the flip side of that is that one of the consequences of moving more and more content into the digital realm has also been that the copyright laws apply much more to certain types of content and certain uses of content that wouldn't previously have been implicated by copyright at all. And I think Google Book Search is an example of this. In the 20th century, if a library made a card catalog, it never would have, the copyright law never would have come into it. But because now Google is trying to build a card catalog with a computer, essentially, suddenly the fact that there are copies made during the process of building this card catalog brings up these copyright questions. So I wonder, is this happening from both ends? On the one hand, the control of producers is being eroded, but on the one hand, the copyrighted law is sort of becoming more intrusive on certain aspects of things that were previously not at all relevant to copyright.
Well, but I mean, but part of that has to do, I think, with your characterization of Google Book Search as a fancy card catalog. I mean, it's obviously wonderful technology, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a long way beyond the card catalog in the sense that it is wholesale copying of these works. And if you go on to Google Book Search, they obviously present actual physical copies of the works. Sometimes for public domain works, the entire work. Obviously, in other situations, what they've been allowed to do through licensing, or in other situations, what they think they can claim with regard to fair use. But I don't think this is just a fancy card catalog. I think it's something much more powerful than that. That makes it what's so wonderful about it. The card catalog was a pretty junky technology.
Sure, it's clearly much powerful, but I don't think the concern is simply the fact that they're presenting these snippets that are larger than what fair use allows. I think even if Google had a technology that didn't show you any of the books, that was strictly a card catalog, but that was built using the scanning technology so that you were making intermediate digital copies of the work, I think you still, I mean, it's not clear, the copyright law I think is unsettled, but there still would at least be an argument that copyright law would apply to the process of building that maybe card catalog, but it isn't the right word, but a full text index. Just the fact that Google has these copies on its computer, I think, makes copyright law apply in a way that if it had been librarians reading the book and doing the same sort of operation in their head, wouldn't have been implicated.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And part of this, you're absolutely right to say, but intermediate copying is sort of interesting and tricky. There are some cases which say, at least under certain circumstances, that's just fine. I think the best case in that known case on that is the Sega versus Accolade case, which involved a situation where you had someone wanting to do some legitimate reverse engineering with regard to how a video game system worked. And the court said, in that context, the intermediate copying that you're describing was protected as fair use. In that situation, the copier destroyed the works afterwards and didn't do anything else with them. If Google had done that, I think we'd be in a very different situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Professor, let me ask you just a much broader question about what the future holds, and this is probably the subject of one of your upcoming essays in the series, but a lot of people in the copyright industries or affected copyright holders have been responding to this and saying, okay, listen, we'll adapt to these technological changes, but law will need to adapt as well, and we will have to make some changes just as we have in the past in response to new technologies. Copyright law will have to adapt. But the problem with that, it seems to me, and tell me your thoughts on this, is that at some point the law just can't keep up, and one wonders, can the courts keep up? How does this play out over the next 10 years? Because in one sense, it strikes me that sort of we ain't seen nothing yet in terms of technological change. Just give us your thoughts on how this plays out over the next few
years.
Well,
you're certainly right to identify that as a central problem for the legal system, and we see that in area after area. We certainly see it in the antitrust area, where the Microsoft case was litigated over many years, and the number of operating systems changed dramatically. That's certainly an issue here as well. I think the question here is the extent to which we're going to be willing to make dramatic changes to the copyright system. We have, in a number of situations in the past, introduce things like compulsory licenses. And the more we head down that path, the more in which we, in some sense, might be able to allow lots of uses to take place and allow lots of copying, but that's going to have to match up with a new compensation model. It's been much harder to design compensation systems than it has been to design the technological systems, and I think we're going to face that for at least another decade.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's morph this discussion and bring in our second speaker, Eric Bangman of Ars Technica. And he wrote an interesting article for Ars a few days ago entitled Major League Baseball Throws High Hard One at Slingbox Over Play Shifting. This is another issue that's been the subject of a lot of ongoing debate at the Tech Liberation Front blog, so our listeners are certainly familiar with this. But, Eric, tell us what's going on right now with the MLB and why they're upset about the Slingbox.
Well, for those that aren't familiar with it, the Slingbox is a device that allows you to watch your TV from any location with a broadband internet connection. It's problematic for Major League Baseball because it allows a Cubs fan like me, perhaps, to watch a Cubs game from my parents' house in suburban Denver, which is Colorado Rockies territory and where the Cubs game might otherwise not be broadcast. So Major League Baseball thinks that that is of the opinion that, that the use of the Slingbox infringes on the contracts that it signed with the cable and satellite TV companies, and that watching a Cubs game in Denver via the Slingbox, even though it's your own TV service, constitutes unauthorized redistribution of the content.
Right. So, Eric, let me play devil's advocate here because, ironically enough, I, too, am a Cubs fan, grew up in the Chicago area. And
sorry to hear that.
I know. I pity us both. We're both damn fools. But the fact is that I remember watching all those games on WGN growing up, as I'm sure you do as well. And, you know, there's something to the notion of sort of territorial exclusivity in terms of the distribution rights of ball games and a lot of media content. This is basically what the whole notion of local broadcasting was built on. Networks would sell certain types of programs, including sports, to local broadcasters who distribute it to their communities. That business model has worked for many, many decades fairly effectively. But now it seems to be challenged by not just technologies like the Slingbox, but also the one I own. I own what's called Sony Location Free TV.
Sure.
And a number of other types of online services that could be a challenge to this, including maybe even something like YouTube. So are you saying or are you thinking that maybe, again, this is just a time when technology is moving faster than law? I mean, is there really any way to stop something like this? What's the worst that could happen? Could MLB basically sue Slingbox out of existence, I guess?
I think so. I mean, it gets back to what Professor Picker said, that consumers are turning into distributors of copyrighted content with the way things are today. And, you know, that's where some of the problems are coming from. And I do think, you know, the local broadcast and in the last couple decades, cable and satellite models are really being challenged, if not stretched to the breaking points, by the recent technological developments in the past few years. You know, it's why the TV networks, like NBC and News Corp, which operates Fox, are partnering on a online portal and video distribution site. It's because the networks realize that the traditional models are breaking down, if not completely broken. And
right.
If they want people to pay attention to their product, they have to give it in a way that the consumer wants to view it and wants to consume it. And those expectations have changed over the past few years.
Right. Well, with the networks, it's a good example. I mean, with the networks, we can easily envision a day just a few years down the road where networks could essentially sell direct. I mean, there's no reason they have to necessarily sell their programs to a local broadcast station. I mean, if they could get out of some of those contracts, they might be able to actually just sell their programs direct, or we download them direct via ABC or Fox's website, right? But
right.
It doesn't strike me that that's the way it's going to work necessarily with baseball. At least that's not the way they want it to work. They're still signing multi-million-dollar, multi-year deals with DirecTV for, like, exclusive contracts, right?
Right, so, but what's different with Major League Baseball and that may be playing into the the dust up over Slingbox right now is that MLB operates MLB.TV, which is a subscription package that gives you access to out-of-market games over a broadband broadband connection. And so I think to a large extent, Major League Baseball's motive here aren't altruistic concerns over copyright holders, but the prospect of losing what might be a paying customer to MLB TV to Slingbox.
You know, the case that really that this reminds me of most is the MP3.com decision in 2000, I think it was. In that case, you had a service called MP3.com that allowed users to stream CDs that they had legally purchased from MP3.com server to any computer where they were logged on. And the court in that case ruled that was an unauthorized redistribution. And I think it's that same issue where basically the question is, do you buy just the physical copy of a work, or do you buy, in a sense, a license to use that work in a manner of your choosing?
Well, that's a good point, but I think one important difference with the Slingbox is that the Slingbox stream that you're viewing is encrypted. So this isn't, you know, something that it's also they released a firmware update last year that disabled another program that could be used to record Slingbox streams. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is in a sense it's content that's locked down from the time that that it leaves your TV set till you view it on your laptop or whatever. So I think it's, you know, might be a little bit of a different issue than the MP3.com.
Well, but with MP3.com was the same way. It was you had to prove to the software that you owned the CD, and then it only allowed the individual user to listen to the music they had previously uploaded. So it wasn't allowing you to share your music with other people or listen to other people's music collections. It was just the music collection that you had already personally bought.
Well, it didn't quite work that way, right? What I needed to do was, so long as I could put a physical CD once into my computer to verify that physical access, then it would give me access to that on an ongoing basis.
That's true.
So if I borrowed 100 CDs from my friends and put them in, I would gain permanent access to that content going forward.
That's true.
Yeah, I think what's different here is that this is actually what's appearing on your own TV at the time, though, right? It seems to me, you know, ACMIRization is a strong supporter of copyright, but this is almost like having a giant telescope peering into what your TV is doing at that time.
That's an excellent illustration.
I mean, I think, interestingly enough, this is going to be a really interesting battle because we heard Blake Krikorian, who's the chairman and CEO of Sling Media, testify at a congressional hearing. He was smart about this. He said, you know, we can make it so you, members of Congress, can view your local district TV while you're here sitting in Congress, and you can keep abreast of what's going on locally and be in better touch with your members. And, in fact, we're making that happen. We'll do that space shifting for you for free. And so, you know, that's powerful. I think that he might actually have won some converts there.
One of the things I find most interesting about this debate is that, as I mentioned, Slingbox was the first to market with this sort of a product, but Sony quickly followed up with their location-free TV product, which I own and use not only on my computer, but it's also accessible through your PlayStation Portable that I have for my kids, and that's a really interesting thing. I could watch it on that as well, but certainly, you know, Sony is a company that's both in the world of electronics and in the world of content. And they appreciate and find copyright important. So certainly the lawyers at Sony must have thought this through at least and said internally, like, we can live with this. This must be legal, and we don't feel that it impacts our own business that negatively. So let's put a product to market that allows this. The rest of the other MPA members along with Sony may not feel the same way, of course. They, of course, are an electronics division. But nonetheless, one wonders, you know, it could be an interesting case of an MPA member versus an MPA member. If someone starts to sue Sling, they'd have to bring Sony into this, I would think.
But Sony doesn't have location-dependent content, I don't think. See, that's what we're seeing with baseball, right? So, and it's that separate. Baseball wants to separate these geographic markets. Sony, mm-hmm. I think, is happy to put all of its content in any market at the same time.
Right.
It doesn't
need
to worry about geographic separation.
That's a good point. Now, that definitely does make the distinction. Anyone else to wrap up on this point, Eric? Anyone?
I just think it's illustrative that this product's been out for well over a year, and there's been a lot of saber rattling. And indeed, this isn't the first time Major League Baseball has talked smack about the sling box, but there hasn't been any. There have not been any lawsuits yet.
Right.
So it just has me wondering if the sports leagues and the other entities that are concerned about the redistribution angle with sling box are, if they're just not really convinced that they have a case.
Eric, could it also be the fact that maybe those in the copyright industries feel that maybe the devil you know is better than the one you don't, and that, you know, Sling and Sony are one thing, but if we essentially go after them, could this all go underground, black market, peer-to-peer, some new technology we can't envision? I mean, it's just a guess, but...
It could that, and it could also be that they could go and lose, and then they have a rather large precedent that, you know, it's basically the Sony Betamax thing.
Right. Right,
all exactly. over again.
Okay, well, let's move on to our final issue. I want to turn to fellow Technology Liberation Front contributor Braden Cox to give us a very quick update on what's been happening in the States on the social networking and age verification front. This is something we've talked quite a bit about in previous podcasts and on the blog. Braden, I was up in Connecticut recently where a big fight is underway on this front between the Attorney General and some others about age verification. I know you were recently down in North Carolina where the issue's red hot and legislation, I believe, just was moving. Could you tell us what's going on?
Sure. You know, hey, we've all seen the issues on Dateline TV where we hear kids being predated upon and they've met somebody online through a social networking site, mostly MySpace. And legislators have heard this call too, unfortunately. And I should say fortunately, because they're putting together some good legislation that would increase, criminal penalties on the bad guys and things like that, and to educate kids. But one thing they haven't been getting right is thinking that they can age verify or mandate age verification on social networking sites. And North Carolina, I should say, is putting an interesting twist on this. They're not mandating age verification per se now. They're just requiring parental consent and parental access to their kids' accounts. Now you can then ask, well, how are they going to determine who they need to require parental access and consent for, because they're going to have to verify kids at some point. And they're also going to have to verify who their parents are, which is, we know, is difficult and impossible with today's technology. In North Carolina, the bill passed the House and passed the Senate, is in the House now. And North Carolina is the one place where I think of all the states, Adam, you mentioned Connecticut, Georgia thought about it earlier this year. It's been introduced just recently in New York, actually, in both the House and the Senate there. North Carolina could be the one place where we see something, because the Attorney General there, Roy Cooper, is extremely powerful and he's extremely motivated to see this bill pass.
Yeah, I agree with that. And two interesting observations, I think, about what's happening in Connecticut and in down in North Carolina. It's that there's still a lot of efforts by the lawmakers to evade the question of exactly how we define social networking. That's not necessarily surprising, because it's a major undertaking. I mean, there are a lot of different examples we've given on the blog about things where there's social networking going on. My personal favorite examples are the MyBarackObama.com webpage, which is a full-fledged social networking site if you go to it and check it out, and yet it's all about political speech. Should you be age verified before you go on MyBarackObama.com? Another example is Xbox 360 Marketplace and online gaming, where you engage with in online gaming with all sorts of people of different ages, and you wear headsets like we're wearing right now, and you interact and chat with them. That's social networking. These things are not being thought out, and that's question one is, you know, are they going to be able to define that, or is that going to be something that's just left open for interpretation later? And then secondly, on this parental consent thing, they're not quite thinking that one through either. In Connecticut, they were having a debate when I was up there about how do we really figure out that the parent is the parent and not just, say, an older brother or something. They've even talked about things like follow-up phone calls once someone's been registered online. Well, you know, I mean, I don't know about most parents, but me, I don't necessarily want to get a million and one phone calls from MySpace or other places that my kids might want to sign up. Again, it shows that there's a compliance issue that I'm not sure they're thinking through. So those are just two observations, Braden, about what I'm hearing. I don't know if you have anything more on that.
No, actually, what I met with legislators yesterday in Raleigh, and the biggest thing that seemed to resonate was the fact that, wow, if I want to get my kid onto these sites, I'm going to have to input all this personally identifiable information and give this to MySpace now, the out-of-wallet type of questions that you have to answer when you try to check your credit report score or something like that. You know, what's your car payment or what's your mortgage payment? Things that are can be verifiable. And, you know, at a time when a lot of people are very hesitant to provide such information, just kind of willy-nilly, I think that a lot of people seem to really think the privacy angle there could be interesting. But unfortunately, Adam, I think, you know, getting to your definition of commercial social networking websites, how do we define that? A lot of these legislators just don't get it. They don't even understand what a social networking website is, and they don't really see the dangers of what happens if you define that broadly and, you know, and where the marketplace is moving.
So is one possible outcome from this just that these sites would simply stop accepting users from North Carolina?
That's an interesting question,
yeah.
And it's been raised, but the question is, of course, how you figure that out. I mean, there are questions about geolocation and if that's possible. There are, of course, ways to evade those sorts of geographic mm-hmm. specific things. So those things have been raised, but, you know, I don't know. I don't know.
Is it an unconstitutional burden on interstate commerce somehow? I don't know. I mean,
this is the COPPA decision.
Well,
interestingly enough, the COPPA decision has been brought up in a couple of state capitals during these debates. And once again, a lot of lawmakers are sort of oblivious to constitutional law or legal precedents.
And they don't care. That's for the courts to decide.
They just don't care. I mean, the courts have decided, and they've said last decision on COPPA spoke very directly to the question of age verification and found it a lot of serious problems and said it was unconstitutional. So, you know, these are things that are on the books, and lawmakers sort of just ignore them and say, well, we're going to pass something anyway.
It sounds exactly like the video game legislation that I cover for Ars Technica. It's the same issues of getting minors involved in what people view as questionable content, in this case, violent video games, mm-hmm. and state legislatures rushing to pass laws without any thought to the consequences and more importantly, the constitutionality of the stuff that they're passing.
You don't pay much of a political price for passing unconstitutional legislation.
That's right.
In the Chicago Tribune, the headline, I think in the Sunday paper, Saturday paper, was about how the Illinois had to raid the welfare fund in order to pay the ESA's legal fees.
right. The ESA is the Entertainment Software Association, the Video Game Industries Association, and they have been recovering significant legal fees in every one of their wins. And I believe the last post I wrote on this for our blog, I believe the latest count is up to 10 decisions, with 10 going in favor of the video game industry and 0 in favor of state and local lawmakers. So that kind of a track record, you think would, you know, somebody would start to pay attention, especially because in most of those cases, the industry's recovered legal fees to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. But mm-hmm. apparently not yet. Apparently they're going to keep trying. Well, that's going to have to do it for this week's Tech Policy Weekly. I want to thank Randy Picker, Eric Bangman, Tim Lee, and Brad Koch for joining us today. And to read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something one of our participants said on today's show, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on that page for the show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, and please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.
Adam, that's a forward slash.
I'm sorry.